To thank you for protecting the future of our programming, Prairie Public wants to offer a free resource so you can protect your own future. Go to prairiepublic.org/freewill to write a legal will at no personal cost and protect what you love.
Join us for a very special program as we bring you the best audio documentaries of the year, the winners of the 2020 Third Coast Competition. Chosen from more than 700 entries, the 11 winners are beautifully crafted original stories from around the world. Come celebrate audio storytelling at its finest with Best of the Best from the Third Coast Festival.
Best of the Best coming up Tuesday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to begin our show with a discussion about the power grid, very much in the news with the disaster that's been unfolding in Texas. And we're going to talk about it with somebody with a unique set of qualifications, particularly for those of us in North Dakota. That's Tony Clark. He's a senior advisor with Wilkinson Barker Knauer in Washington, D.C., former commissioner with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and former chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Doug, it's good to be here. Thank you.
I mentioned that you're working with this LLP now in Washington. You spent years as an energy policymaker. What's your role now?
So now I do primarily energy regulatory consulting. A lot of it is for utility companies, doing both sort of strategic inward-facing consulting, but also some expert witness work in different jurisdictions and in front of regulatory commissions and things like that.
What caused the failures in Texas from your perspective? I'm sure you were interested in it.
Yeah, it has been sort of a cataclysmic event, I think is one way of putting it, in the energy industry here over the last week. Having a series of blackouts like has happened in Texas is probably the biggest event in electricity in decades, dating back, and certainly one of the largest blackouts in American history. The root cause analyses and all of that from an engineering side is going to be studied for some time to come, and in the succeeding months will be looked at, although there is some preliminary information that seems to be coming out that would give a pretty good idea of what we think happened in Texas and in some ways affected a good portion of the Great Plains all the way up to co-ops
yes.
in North Dakota. So the most proximate event that happened that caused the blackouts is, of course, the much colder than expected winter weather that dipped down into the southern plains. So it was one big weather system, but it affected different systems differently. The most catastrophic events were clearly inside Texas itself. As a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, know, and all Americans are learning about this week, Texas basically has its own grid, most of the state. And it's disconnected from other grids around the country. And so it's not interstate in nature. So it's really regulated within Texas. There's not a lot of federal policy overlay on the top of it. And that's the grid that was most affected, where there were mass blackouts, millions of people without power for days. The system also affected grids around Texas. One of them that it affected harder than most was what's known as the Southwest Power Pool, or SPP. SPP is basically a grid operator that manages a portion of the grid from Texas all the way, or from North Dakota all the way down to the panhandle of Texas, covers Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, sort of the Great Plains region. And there are several cooperative providers, rural electric co-ops in North Dakota that are part of SPP. And SPP itself also had stress conditions. It responded better than the Texas system, although even as far north in North Dakota, the grid operator required basically rolling blackouts where for 15, 20, maybe 45 minutes at a time, something like that, there were controlled blackouts to try to maintain the stability of the grid. But it, in terms of impact two different stories. I mean, Texas was a very severe impact and impacted millions of people. And it was, whereas the SVP system, blackouts, but much more controlled and for a much shorter duration.
So the big picture seems to be that the Texas system wasn't prepared for the profoundly cold weather that hit it, that wasn't winterized, and pieces of the grid started going offline, and there was like a compounding effect, a snowball effect?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. The cold weather's the heart of it, and you hear a lot of people referring to the winterization of the grid, which is basically the power plants that the grid operator thought were going to come online ended up in, it appears, freezing up in a lot of instances, and they weren't winterized. As someone who deals in the regulatory world, what I immediately start thinking about is what's the regulatory policy that led to that happening?
And
generators not investing in the winterization and the equipment and the firm gas supplies and all of that they should have. And that is one area that's going to be debated for some period of time, especially in Texas, because Texas has a very different energy regulatory model than we have in North Dakota or really a lot of states around the country do, which is that Texas, like a few other states, California and some parts of the Northeast, about 20, 25 years ago, they quote unquote deregulated or restructured their energy companies. In other words, the utility companies in Texas don't own the generation that is used to provide power to Texans. Those assets were divested into independent companies, and these independent generating companies are dependent on market signals to decide whether they'll invest and whether to shut down plants and things like that. And there appears that there was a disconnect here, where those markets that Texas designed did not reward generators to invest in things like better winterization or firmer power supplies or things like that. And that's, in my mind, one of the root causes of this is that deregulation regime that Texas implemented. And I'm sure that folks in Texas and policymakers there are going to be re-looking at whether that was really a good policy.
I know that then Governor George W. Bush signed the legislation to isolate Texas in 1999, and former Energy Secretary Rick Perry, a Texan, has been defending that process. Does this mean then that consumers in Texas have an option of what power company to buy their power from?
Well, so the way that it works in Texas, and this is true in a good part of the Northeast as well, New England, New York, and parts of the Mid-Atlantic, the way that it works there is you have a wires company that's still a regulated monopoly. So the wire coming into your house, you still just have one wire. But the utility that owns the wires 20 years ago was forced to sell off all of its generation to other independent entities. And then customers can go out and they can contract with whoever they want to actually produce the power. The way that Texas market is set up is whatever generator is producing at the least cost at that very moment is the generator that gets called upon to produce energy. And the theory being that that'll drive efficiencies. The problem is that when you set up a market like that, if you're a generator that owns, for example, a gas plant, and you've got lots of other generators that own gas plants, and you're competing against them for the lowest price at that very moment, you're probably not going to invest in winterizing your plant in anticipation of a 1-in-10-year event or a 1-in-20-year event. And the reason you won't do that is it costs a lot to winterize your plants. And if you're building for the 1-in-10-year event, basically you're bankrupt before you ever have an opportunity to make money in that 1-in-10-year event, because all of your competitors didn't invest in the winterization. So it becomes a collective action problem, in a sense. In a regulated state like North Dakota or most of the country, utilities plan for worst-case scenarios. So they tend to to build the system in mind with the idea that you need to build it for those days when it is going to be the coldest or it's the hottest and the system is stressed. And so there's a little bit more cushion or a little headroom that's built in to the utilities in, say, North Dakota and much of the Midwest as compared to a state like Texas where it was all deregulated and it was just these sort of what's cheapest right now to produce power that drove all of the investment decisions by the generating companies.
And then, of course, the backside of that is that when you have something happen like what happened in Texas and energy becomes much rarer, it becomes much more expensive. And we're hearing about utility bills for Texas consumers that are in the multiple thousands of dollars now. What's their recourse?
Well, that's exactly the thing. Once you deregulate, the idea is that you're supposed to take those regulations out of the way and consumers fend for themselves in the marketplace. Different customers in Texas have different types of companies that they went through to deliver their energy. Some will probably be more impacted than others. The one that really stands out as a particularly bad outcome is one company that exposed the deal with that company was they said they would expose you as a customer to whatever the wholesale price was at that very moment. And when wholesale prices were really cheap, which they've been for the most part for the last several years, thanks to low-cost natural gas, that worked pretty well. But when prices go through the roof, which is what happened in Texas, I mean, Texas, the price cap on their market is $9,000 per megawatt hour, which is a little hard to get your head around, but to give you an idea, in other markets, that price cap might be something more like $1,000 a megawatt hour, $2,000, something like that. So this was many multiples what any market in the country elsewhere would have seen. And in the case of those customers who are signed up with a company that provides direct access to whatever the energy price is at that moment, those people will be getting extraordinarily high bills. And I'm not sure what the legal recourse will be for them.
Well, let's talk about the grid structure in our state. It has, according to some people, been under stress, and part of the reason is because we're going through a transition period in terms of the way we generate power. How should North Dakota, which shares a similar energy mix with fossil fuel and renewables as Texas, view what happened? And given as you pointed out, we have a different sort of regulatory structure in our state. Nevertheless, what can we do to make our grid more secure?
A couple things about North Dakota more specifically. North Dakota, there's actually two grid operators who operate within the state. One is SPP, who we've already talked about, and like I said, several of the REC co-ops are members of SPP. And the other one is known as the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO. And the three investor-owned utilities in North Dakota are members of that, so XL, Otter Tail, and Montana-Dakota Utilities. And so in North Dakota, the key is going to be, number one, understanding that we are part of a regional grid, and that was really brought home this week. By all accounts, the generating assets in North Dakota and in and around North Dakota and surrounding states actually performed very well from all reports. The issue with the rolling blackouts, the limited duration ones that happened in North Dakota, was related again to the Southern Plains, where some of the utilities didn't winterize as high as they should, but I'm guessing will be winterizing to a higher level in the future. So that will help. So it sort of proves that events that happen, you know, many hundreds of miles away from North Dakota can have an impact on the grid, and recognizing that. So working with our regional partners and regional peers in other states and utilities in other states to shore up and make sure that the investments are made to make the grid as resilient as it can be. The other thing will be to make sure that the state and its utilities really focus in on this idea that we have in the utility industry, which is known as resource adequacy, which just basically means, does the system have the resources available to provide energy 24/7, 365, given a number of different operating conditions. And as I said, North Dakota's system on the whole has held up pretty well to this point, but we need to make sure that those investments are continued to be made here, make sure we have the right regulatory structure to support those investments, and I think we do in the upper Midwest, but then make sure that we're coordinating with the rest of the region so that others in the region also are making those right investments, which shores up the grid. But it's going to take all sorts of resources. I mean, anyone who says you can do it with, you know, just coal or just wind or just solar or just battery storage, I mean, it is probably wrong. I mean, every resource has its attributes and plays a role, and you need them all to make sure that you have that resilient grid.
Tony Clark is a senior advisor on energy policy with a Washington firm, and he's also a former commissioner with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and a former chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Tony, as I'm sure you're aware, everything is political these days, including the grid. And when the
right
problem hit Texas, there was some initial comments about what caused it, and wind energy was pointed out as a possible culprit, and that's since been debunked a bit. But let's talk about the transition we're making from traditional fossil fuels to renewable energy, and that's certainly big in North Dakota and in Texas. Wind energy is a big deal. What do we have to do to make the grid a 21st century, you know, transporter of power from many different kinds of sources, including maybe me at home?
Right, yeah. So you're right, Doug. The grid is undergoing a transition, and we need to make sure that transition happens in a smart way and in a measured way, and in a way that keeps the lights on, because you just cannot have situations like we saw over this last week, especially in the dead of winter, and especially in a place like the Northern Plains where it can be a life or death thing. So as I indicated before, I think the key is to understand that each resource has its place, and understand that utilities build different types of resources for different reasons. So take, for example, renewables like wind. Wind is usually built by utilities as a price hedge. It's what we call in the business, it's an energy resource as opposed to a capacity resource. So when the wind is blowing, it's a great resource, and it keeps prices low for consumers because it's a zero fuel cost resource. And so it allows for a utility a bit of a price hedge just in case fuel cost spike, for example. It also has a great emissions profile from an environmental standpoint, and so utilities will build renewables to decrease their emissions profile for environmental regulations. Other resources have, again, getting back to this idea of capacity, they serve a better capacity value, which means they're available when called upon. Wind can't serve that, because it works when it's blowing and it doesn't work when it's not blowing. But you need capacity resources as well, so that when you're in those conditions where the renewables may not be producing, you still have reliable power. So those capacity resources tend to be things like coal plants or natural gas plants, nuclear units or another capacity resource. So you need the right mix of both those always available capacity resources, as well as the energy resources that help provide you with other attributes on the system.
We didn't talk about one thing which was alluded to during the Texas emergency, and it just occurred to me, something that's called a black start, which means, I think, that the grid totally fails, and that
right.
The utility companies or those people who are feeding and operating the grid need to do a very measured restart, and it can take a very long time.
That's exactly right, Doug. The reason that you saw, take for example SPP, the reason that they had these controlled 20-minute, half-hour outages here and there was they were trying to balance the grid, and what that means is electricity is a very unique resource. It's in some ways unlike just about any resource that we have, in that it has to be produced at exactly the same time as it's consumed.
Yes.
And so the system has to always be in balance between what's being taken off the system and what's being produced at the system. So grid operators have to keep that that stability on it. And one of the reasons that grid operators will order things like rolling blackouts is kind of a last case or a last-ditch effort to try to avoid instability on the system. Because what can happen if it's allowed to get too far out of whack is you will begin having the cascading outages that are uncontrolled, that engineers have no control over, and the system can start to really just break down entirely. Once you get into that, then you get into what you refer to as these black start situations, which is the grid is down. And in those cases, then engineers do have manuals that they hope they never have to use, because you never want to get the grid into that situation. But different generators have to be brought on at different times in order to ensure that the grid can come back online. And it's a complicated issue, because you're trying to not just some units, once they go down, take a long time to get back up. Some units can ramp up faster, but they would have to be brought back online in a certain order and matched to what the demand is at specifically that time. And so that's the worst case scenario, because that can last several days, several weeks, and the engineers who run the grid hope they never get into those black start situations where the entire grid has gone down and you're having to restart it from scratch.
The grid's ability to balance the load between generation and demand is one thing. What about its vulnerability to hacking?
Well, this is something that has concerned the utility industry and regulators. It certainly was something that concerned me when I was on FERC, and just as a private citizen now, it continues to concern me. In the past, when we talked about reliability events, and I'm talking about, you know, pre, say, year 2000, most of the attention was focused on what we call kind of the nuts and bolts of reliability. It's things like squirrels chewing through lines, right? Or in the case of the blackout in the early 2000s, it was trees fell into some high voltage power lines in Ohio and it caused a blackout across the Northeast. It was really just like the blocking and tackling of keeping the lights on is what really concerned us from a reliability standpoint. Starting about probably 10 or 15 years ago, this issue of cybersecurity and cyber hacking became probably just as big a concern, because the systems are more and more dependent on control systems that may be, if not protected, vulnerable to hacking. And so that's just an ongoing concern. It's something that federal regulators, utilities have been working to try to address as fast as they can to make sure that those systems are as resilient against cyber attack as they can be. But where the grid is going, the computer automation that we have throughout the grid, it's just going to be something that has to be built into the design of these systems in terms of trying to make them as resilient as possible from cyber attack.
Tony Clark is a senior energy advisor with Wilkinson Barker Knauer in Washington, D.C., former commissioner with FERC and a former chair of the North Dakota PSC. Tony, thanks for shedding some light on what has been a dark period in history for those folks in Texas, and we hope it never comes here. Appreciate your expertise and your time with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Doug. Good to be with you.
Coming up on Main Street, a showcase for the craft of quilting is coming to the North Dakota Heritage Center. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota House has passed a bill to prevent governments from imposing mask mandates. The bill's sponsor is Minot Republican Representative Jeff Hoverson. He told the House he has received a lot of emails. Virtually all were for his bill and against mask mandates.
They do not want North Dakota to get sucked into what is becoming obvious. The mask is a part of a larger apparatus of a movement of unelected, wealthy bureaucrats who are robbing our freedoms and perpetuating lies.
Bismarck Republican Representative Jason Doctor argued against the measure, saying having a ban on governments adopting mask mandates takes away local control.
If people want to decide to have a mandate for a certain organization or certain political subdivisions, they should have that choice. But they should also have the choice not to mandate. And I think as lawmakers, if we're going to pass a bill that just says absolutely no mandates, no matter what, under no circumstances, what does that tell you about those are the same people that talk about local control?
The bill passed on a 50-44 vote. As a new $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package makes its way through Congress, North Dakota state officials are looking at how much the state could receive and how much money could how the money could be used. State lawmakers say the state could receive $4 billion from that package, and the Senate Majority Leader says it'll go towards one-time spending. Dickinson Republican Senator Rich Wardner says $1 billion could go toward erasing the unfunded liability in the Public Employees Retirement Fund. And Wardner says some could go towards roads and bridges.
There's no question. We have some places, especially in the eastern part of the state, where you have township and county roads that have been inundated with water, and they need to be fixed. And these, we got farmers there and agribusiness people that got to get their crops to market, and they're having a tough time getting it done.
Wardner says if the money comes through after the legislative session gavels out, he expects lawmakers will come back in a special session to take care of the spending plans. And the state Senate has made some changes to a bill allowing for a legislative session to be called in the even number years to deal with budget issues. The bill in its original form passed last Friday with one senator absent and Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford casting the vote to break the tie. But the absent senator was back Monday, and he moved to reconsider the measure. The bill's original sponsor, Williston Republican Senator Brad Beckedahl, offered an amendment calling for a one-time session in 2022.
We're looking at a session that's unique in dealing with COVID. As you saw from the budget proposed from the Department of Health, we're still spending hundreds of millions of dollars on its impact to our economy and our citizens, and that will continue into the next biennium. We have several fiscal issues hanging over us. We have the ever-present price of oil and price of our commodities in the agriculture sector. We also have the Dakota Access Pipeline issue, which is looming large over our revenue stream in the next year, which may or may not be decided before we leave these chambers this year.
Beckedahl says the 80-day limit for the legislature to meet over the two-year period remains in effect. The amended measure passed 28-19. It will now be considered in the House, barring further reconsideration. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Michelle Doyle. She's a member of the Bismarck Mandan Capital Quilters Guild. We're going to talk about quilting and about an event that's coming up that will showcase what they do. Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Doug.
Tell us about the Capital Quilters Guild. Who belongs? What does it do?
Well, the Capital Quilters Guild is celebrating our 40th anniversary this year in 2021, and we are a guild that has about 63 members right now. We meet once a month. We have our guild meeting, and then we have workshops. So our purpose is to promote patchwork, quilting arts, applique, all things quilting.
Do you look for a particular skill level, or can anybody, somebody who's interested in learning about quilting or somebody who's a master quilter, is this a common organization?
We love them all. We welcome all levels of quilting. And we actually, one of my favorite aspects of our guild is that it is multi-generational. So we have members who are grandmothers, mothers, daughters, and aunts, and it's just wonderful to have that family generational heritage.
How did you get involved?
I got involved actually when I lived in Devil's Lake. And Devil's Lake had a wonderful, and still does have a wonderful, quilt guild. Those of us who are quilters have a fondness for fabric. And we like to create things that are useful. And quilts are all of that, beautiful and useful, and we get to use our hand skills and our needlework.
There's lots of information at your website, ndcapitalquilters.com, and up there I discovered, among other things, that there are 36 quilt guilds in North Dakota. That I did not know.
Well, there could be more, there could be less now. Our organization is one of two that are active in Bismarck Mandan.
Has the pandemic affected what you do at your meetings and getting together and all of that stuff?
Yes, the pandemic has affected all aspects. It's affected our meetings, but we quilters say that we were born for this pandemic because we can just hunker down in our quilt rooms and not be bothered by anything, keep ourselves isolated and keep ourselves busy. We've done some virtual meetings just to keep in touch, but you know, it just isn't the same. So our membership has fallen off a bit. We are starting to meet again now. We have a large facility and we can certainly distance, but we have not started resuming our workshops. We get our meeting, our business meeting done, and then we go home.
When you meet at the New Song Church in Bismarck, and so I assume that's the large meeting space that you have.
Yes, and actually that's a new venue for us. We, for many years, had a lovely spot at Edgewood Vista, one of the senior living centers in Bismarck. And that was such a nice venue for us, and it was wonderful for the residents there. They would come to our workshops. Sometimes they would participate, sometimes they would just observe, but they were always interested in what we were doing with our sewing machines and our fabrics and our all of our tools. But of course, when the pandemic hit, they had to close their doors and we had to find a different meeting spot.
When I went to ndcapitalquilters.com, I saw a number of your projects up there, and one of them is pandemic-related, and that is making face masks, obviously using your sewing skills in a way that met an immediate need.
That's exactly right. Our members went right to work, and we made hundreds of face masks for hospitals, for the schools around here, for different organizations that requested them.
You've got a big event coming up. It's coordinated with National Quilting Day, which is March 12th through the 14th. You've got an event coming up at the State Historical Society of North Dakota in Bismarck at the museum, that area there. If Quilts Could Talk, a Bed Turning. Tell us about this event.
This event is one of our 40th anniversary celebrations. It's hosted by the North Dakota Heritage Center and the Historical Society. And we have a long history of events, coordinating events with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. This one is a different kind of quilt show. Our members are submitting their quilts, and the bed turning will be held at the Russell Reed Auditorium. So it'll be set up on stage and there will be two beds set up. And in a bed turning, you pile your quilts one on top of the other and you peel them back to reveal the quilt underneath. And that's why they call it a bed turn. So we'll have stacks of quilts and they'll be featured on stage, and every quilt has its own story. So the members have submitted their narratives. Some of the quilts are again, generational quilts, and they've been in their families for many years. And some of them are COVID quilts that were fresh made during their isolation in their quilt rooms.
This is Sunday, March 14th. It's open to the public. It's free. It runs from 2 to 3 Central Time in the Russell Reed Auditorium at the North Dakota Heritage Center. And so the members are offering a bit of a narrative about why they made this particular quilt?
That's right. Yes, every quilt has its own story.
Does the Heritage Center have quilts that are part of their collection?
They certainly do. We're going to bring out a few of them that are associated with our Capitol quilters. One will be the Millennium Quilt. Our Capitol quilters asked quilt guilds around the state to submit a block in the year 2000. And our guild put that together into what we called the Millennium Quilt. And we used it to show hand quilting and different techniques when we constructed the quilt. And then in 2009, it was put into the state archive. So we're going to bring that one out. We're going to bring out the governor's quilt. That was a quilt made during Governor Sooner's time in office. And our guild and many guilds made quilts and donated to the governor's residence. So those will be two special quilts. And then we actually have two charter members still alive who are going to be featured at the event, and we're going to have some of their quilts. So it should be a lot of fun.
And I saw on your website there was also a North Dakota Centennial quilt. I assume that was around 1989. You've got some important history there in the among your quilters.
Well, the Centennial quilt was not a guild project. That was more of a homemaker's project.
Ah.
And if you remember back then, it was a huge quilt. I believe the dimensions were 45 feet by 120.
My goodness.
That one is not housed at the Heritage Center, actually. So we will not be featuring that quilt.
When your members get together, are they working on just their own projects, or are there common projects that they work on? Maybe make what I guess is called a block, a piece of a quilt.
Members get together in a workshop. We usually have one of the members presenting a project, and that could be a particular quilt block. It could be a project like a project bag. So we like to complete a project during a workshop. But lately we've had kind of open workshop, so people can bring their sewing machines and work on whatever they want to work on. But we hope to get back to our normal activity of teaching and promoting our craft.
When I was a kid, of course, my grandparents, my grandmothers made quilts. And their mothers made quilts. So there were quilts that were handed down generation to generation. I think most of them got used a lot and terribly frayed and eventually weren't anything but tatters. But this process that I recall, these were like piecemeal pieces, but there are different kinds of quilts that aren't just using whatever fabric is left over.
That's correct. Nowadays, it really is an art, and there are traditional patterns, there are modern patterns, there are what we call art quilts that are a work of art all on its own. And there still are many quilts that are made from, well, old shirts, neckties, uniforms even. There's a
yes.
There's a whole industry of what we call memory quilts. You've probably seen the t-shirt quilts. They're quite popular.
I have. I was just going to mention that. They're all over online these days. So it's a craft and an art. You know, you might put the quilt on the bed. You might put it on the wall, I guess.
Yep, exactly.
When I went to that website, indycapitalquilters.com, I also found out about a couple of other projects that are kind of touching, actually. The Million Pillowcase Challenge and Quilts for Veterans. Are you still doing that stuff?
We are doing the Million Pillowcase Challenge, yes. That is a popular charity project that all the guild members participate in. We make pillowcases. And there are 25 charities, local charities, that we donate pillowcases to. And we've been doing that for 11 years now, and we'll continue to do that. We started in 2010, and it was actually a challenge that came from American Patchwork and Quilting. It was a national challenge for guilds or individuals to make pillowcases for charity, and the goal was to reach 1 million, which they did, I think, in December of 2020. But we're going to continue making pillowcases because they're cherished and useful, and our charities still appreciate them.
And they're unique.
Oh, they're beautiful. Some are beautiful, yes. They're quite lovely.
And now, when participants in the guild take part in those guild projects, I gather there are some incentives. There are like prizes for people who, you know, help out.
The Quilts for Veterans is a charity project that we've been doing for about the last 5 years. Typically, they're a lap quilt, and they went to the veterans' home in Lisbon. But now in Bismarck, we have an official Quilts of Valor organization, which is a national nonprofit. It's the Missouri River Quilts of Valor. So our guild now supports the Quilts of Valor's efforts, and that's been a really popular organization here. We've only been around since actually March of last year and have done a lot of quilts for veterans.
Michelle Doyle is a member of the Bismarck-Mandan Capital Quilters Guild. Michelle, how does the organization fund itself? I assume it's largely voluntary, but there must be some money that has to be raised.
We do raffle quilts. Raffle and the group, our guild will get together and select a pattern, purchase the materials, get the quilt made. We raffle it off, usually at our quilt fest on the even years. So every 2 years we have a quilt fest. We bring in national teachers, regional teachers. We have a big quilt show, and we sell raffle tickets for our quilt. And then the quilt fest itself is a moneymaker for us. That's how we keep going. Plus, you know, we don't have a lot of overhead, so we don't need a lot.
And you've got a big event coming up. Again, we'll remind our listeners that If Quilts Could Talk, A Bed Turning will be a special presentation at the State Historical Society of North Dakota on Sunday, March 14th from 2 to 3 in the Russell Reed Auditorium at the Center. And I assume you'll be there, Michelle, and if people want more information, they can find it at ndcapitalquilters.com. Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Imagine a superpower that allowed you to know exactly what people thought of you. Would that be empowering or debilitating?
There are times where I feel as though naivete kept me safe. There are also times where I felt as though I was extremely vulnerable as a result.
The Paradox of Knowledge, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Years before North Dakota became a state, the Northern Pacific was laying track for another stretch of intercontinental railroad. A bridge between Morehead and Fargo overcame one obstacle, but the Missouri River separating Bismarck and Mandan was a whole new level of difficult. NDSU Professor Tom Ezern says the span that bridged that gap made history, and it should be preserved, in part to honor the men who suffered to build it. Here's his Plainsfolk essay titled, Caisson Disease.
The self-taught engineering genius behind the construction of the Northern Pacific Railroad Bridge, completed 1882, spanning the Missouri River at Bismarck, was George Shattuck Morrison. At the time of his death on July 1, 1903, at the age of 61, the geologist and historian Edward C. Murphy writes, Morrison was regarded by many to be the leading bridge engineer in America, if not the entire world. Read Murphy's article in North Dakota History. Study Morrison's own report to the Northern Pacific Railroad, which you can find online or browse in person at the State Archives. Examine his signed drawings of the design and details incorporated into the report. Go out and have a look yourself at the elegant and durable structure still in service at the heart of North Dakota. And you have to agree with Murphy's assessment. Perhaps even drop the qualifiers. Morrison is the greatest bridge builder in American engineering history. Perhaps I ought not to mention this, since I serve a university that trains engineers in droves, but here it is. Morrison never studied structural engineering formally. He learned it on the job. He was a liberal arts grad with a law degree from Harvard. He could read and write, he could execute drawings, he could see the big picture, and he could reason out problems and solve them. He was the perfect exemplar of Gilded Age engineering. And we have the perfect example of his genius and craft right here in the middle of the Flickertail State, if we can keep it. As one of those fuzzy-headed liberal arts grads who lacks the free-ranging acuity of a guy like Morrison, I can understand just enough of his exhaustive report to see what he's trying to do. And I confess, I really like the pictures. The most gripping image he renders is Plate 10, showing the process of sinking the caisson, it says. When you look at the bridge today, your eye is drawn to the great stone piers on which the iron and steel elements rest. They are impressive stonework, but the granite sits atop massive concrete foundations that were poured deep underwater. This was accomplished, the river gravel vacuumed out, forms emplaced, concrete inserted, through the use of pneumatic caissons, pressurized chambers in which men worked at or below the bottom of the Missouri River. This was a fairly new technology, and there were hazards. So now perhaps we should shift our attention from the engineering genius to the situation of the poor blokes laboring at the bottom of these caissons, as graphically depicted by Plate 10. The Tribune described their situation. The workmen will descend to the working chamber through cylinders of iron provided with iron ladder rounds. Before entering these, two iron doors have to be passed through, which fit their casings of iron and rubber airtight. A chamber separates these, and one door cannot be opened until the other is closed. The air pressure in the caissons had to be raised and lowered for the convenience of handling materials, and laborers had to descend and ascend so that they were subject to what was known as caisson disease, what deep-sea divers call the bends. Morrison does not deal with this difficulty in his report, leaving us to think there were no such problems on his project. But Murphy, the historian, and I are skeptical. The genius of Gilded Age engineering did not extend much into the realm of worker safety or any other kind of concern for workers. Instead, Morrison disparaged the quality of his workmen and wondered in print why they kept quitting the project. There is historic engineering to view, and there are blood and tears to remember, too, at the site of this bridge.
That's Tom Ezern. Next, more history from Dakota Date Book.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more, easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 22nd. Smallpox ravaged the world for centuries before it was eradicated by vaccination in 1980. In what is now North Dakota, smallpox devastated native tribes and instilled a real fear among people for many years. The contagious virus was pervasive and found its way everywhere, even the state capital. In 1903, first-term Representative Mike Maddock of Benson County had returned to the capital from his home near Esmond and complained to fellow lawmakers he had been feeling ill. A doctor examined him and immediately diagnosed smallpox. Maddock was removed to a pest house in Bismarck to quarantine.
He had been in the House chamber but a few moments. But on this date in 1903, the House chamber still underwent a two-day fumigation and disinfection as a precaution against any stray smallpox germs. Maddox's diagnosis caused considerable excitement in the House corridors. No other lawmakers took ill, although some were exposed. A cloakroom attendant who boarded with Maddox and Bismarck did fall ill. Both men recovered in a Bismarck hospital. Sick for weeks, Maddox wasn't able to return to the legislature, which adjourned before his release. He received excellent care at the hospital, but just a year later, he died from stomach cancer at the age of 42. Around the time of Maddox's release from the hospital, a Williston newspaper commented that each session of the legislature seems to have a smallpox scare. Many people in Bismarck got vaccinated after the cases at the Capitol. Other parts of North Dakota saw smallpox erupt that winter in 1903. Some families in Linton were quarantined in a dual epidemic of smallpox and diphtheria. Rumors spread that only mail carriers were allowed in or out of town. Linton's hotel was closed, quarantined, and fumigated. The town's telephone office in the quarantined hotel was relocated to the bank. A barber shop in Kensal was quarantined after several smallpox cases were traced to the barber. The barber had reportedly continued to operate his shop even after the disease was plain upon his features. The county's Board of Health and the Kensal School Board ordered vaccination for school children and everyone else who had not been vaccinated. In Richland County, a health board member was assaulted while putting quarantine signage on a home of smallpox patients. The assailants were arrested, fined $30, and jailed for failure to pay the fine. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Biden administration wants to prioritize people of color and others who are most vulnerable to COVID-19 for vaccines. But in many parts of this country, only a small percentage have gotten a dose.
The challenges in ensuring equity are just very, very large. And even despite having our eyes on the ball, you know, the numbers don't really satisfy anybody.
Vaccine outreach complications on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, we talked about the energy grid with Tony Clark today. On our show tomorrow, we'll talk with John Bagieu, who lives off the grid. We'll talk about what it takes to become energy self-sufficient, and we'll share a Conversations on Healthcare podcast about how COVID-19 is revealing huge gaps in health equity and public health readiness. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.